You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study finds that microplastic pollution is showing up in tap water coming from the Great Lakes and in the region's beer. The lead researcher joins us to share the details.
First, there's a long-running debate over transportation funding in Wisconsin. In recent years, local governments have relied more heavily on additional vehicle registration fees, or wheel taxes, as they're often known, to fund local roads.
Wheel taxes aren't a new thing in Wisconsin, but as our next guest points out, they haven't been used all that often until recently. In 2011, only four communities in the state had the additional fee. By the end of last year, that number had jumped to 27.
Jason Stein is a research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which just released a new report on the rise of wheel taxes in the state. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me. A pleasure.
So we got to it a little bit in the intro, but help us get a sense of just how much of an increase we've seen in these wheel taxes and the money that's been raised from them.
Well, it's a substantial increase. Now, it's starting out from a very small base, but we are seeing this nearly sevenfold increase in the number of communities in the state that have put in place a wheel tax, which is also sometimes known as a registration fee that motorists have to pay. And we're seeing the revenues that are coming from these wheel taxes nearly triple from $7 million to $20.7 million.
So that's a pretty significant jump in the returns on these fees. And we said that they went from 4 to 27 communities. So for those people in those communities, how much do these fees typically run?
I mean, you know, it varies at the state level. It's in the $80 range, and you know, it's typically something smaller than that at the local level. You know, most communities in the state, I mean, we have 72 counties and we have 600 cities and villages. You know, most communities still do not have one of these wheel taxes, but obviously, you know, the number has grown substantially, and there are other communities that have debated either putting one in place or increasing it, so we felt like it was worth highlighting that for voters and elected officials in the state.
It might be a little too early to tell, but does there seem to be an increased interest in doing this, in having these wheel taxes, if we're seeing a little bit of success in the, albeit a smaller portion of the state, you know, seeking these out?
Well, I mean, I think all communities in the state are facing similar pressures, and those are that over time, the state aid that goes to communities for roads has lagged inflation, at least up until this current budget. Now, communities did get an increase in state aids for their local roads in the current budget, but that's a trend that happened up until now. And then as well, we're also seeing deteriorating conditions on the roads in the state. So if you're a local elected leader and you're seeing that, you know, roads in your state are not as good now as they were a few years ago, and at least up to this current budget, your state aid for roads hasn't kept pace with inflation, then, you know, it's understandable why a local elected official might look to, you know, some other source of revenue that might help them pay for the infrastructure needs in their community.
So in these communities that have, you know, decided to pursue wheel taxes, what can they do with the money raised from them, and what can they absolutely not do with it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they need to use this money for infrastructure and roads. So they you know, they can't raise this money, this wheel tax, and then go and use it for park spending or something like that. But what they can do is, for every dollar that goes into, you know, from the wheel tax into their local road spending, that's a dollar that they, you know, don't have to take off the property levy and the property tax levy, and they may be able to use that for parks and recreation, or they might be able to use that for police or fire services. So, you know, the money has got to be for roads, but it allows other money to flow into different priorities that communities have.
We are talking to Jason Stein. He's the research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. That organization just put out a new study that looks at wheel taxes and how they have kind of grown in popularity in the state to fund local roads. So, Jason, one of the questions that people might ask is, you know, who actually is responsible for paying for the roads? There's always a big argument up at the Capitol mm-hmm. about it, but it trickles down to this, you know, the community, the town level. Absolutely. Can you break Absolutely. That down for us?
Well, I mean, here's a couple of things that voters can think about as they decide, to, you know, what do they think of this trend? First of all, is that wheel taxes are something that is paid by the people who live in a community. So if there are people that are driving in from outside that community and using the roads, they're not necessarily paying that tax the way, you know, somebody from out of state might come in and pay the gas tax when they fill up at a gas station in Wisconsin. They wouldn't be paying the wheel tax. And then the other point is that, you know, right now in Wisconsin, it's a flat per vehicle fee. So in other words, if you have a very nice and nifty automobile, you're going to pay that flat fee. If you have a very rundown automobile that is on its last legs and you're using it to get to work and you're a low-income family, you're going to pay the same fee. So, you know, those are a couple factors that voters and local officials may think about, lawmakers, as they decide how they view this trend.
And lawmakers on the whole, and right now I'm thinking specifically of Governor Walker, what have they said about local communities seeking out this kind of revenue?
Right. So, I mean, there's two big picture things. One is that obviously Governor Walker and Republican lawmakers who control the legislature have said that they don't want to raise the gas tax or wheel taxes, vehicle fees at the state level to provide more revenues for roads. You know, what Governor Walker has said about these local wheel taxes so far, I believe, is that, you know, that it's a local decision for elected officials and voters in these respective communities.
And but couldn't that potentially, if, you know, you have one community that has these wheel taxes and it's impacting that community, and then maybe a neighboring community does not, are we just going to see a patchwork potentially of roads in the state?
Well, I mean, that's certainly what we have now, and we couldn't really discern a pattern in terms of which communities put these in place. I mean, we obviously see, you know, some big counties like Milwaukee County putting a wheel tax in place, as well as some small counties like Lincoln and Iowa counties. So you're seeing it in both large and small communities. Yeah, I mean, there may be a rhyme and reason to it, but not one that we've necessarily seen definitively, and it's certainly something that, you know, depending on how future state budgets play out, we may see more of.
In that vein, do you expect to see this trend of wheel taxes continuing?
I mean, it's certainly possible, because you have to remember as well that local communities have their growth in the property tax capped by state limits. So unless they're getting new construction or they go to referendum, they can't raise their property tax levies. So this is something that it may not be their preferred way to raise new revenue, but they may decide, well, we feel like it's such a priority to have more money for roads that we're going to do this.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Jason Stein is research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which just released a new report on the rise of wheel taxes throughout the state.
Microplastic pollution is showing up in waterways around the world, including the Great Lakes.
A recent study out of the University of Minnesota found microplastics in Milwaukee tap water, as well as store-bought sea salt and 12 brands of beer from the Great Lakes region. What's still unclear is the impact that drinking microplastics could have.
Mary Kosuth is an assistant professor at Dunwoody College of Technology in Minneapolis, where she teaches environmental science. She was the lead researcher on this study. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what is a microplastic?
So technically, a microplastic is anything that's less than 5 millimeters in length, although there's some work that's trying to make that upper limit a little bit smaller to 1 millimeter, but currently it includes 5 millimeters. And there's no absolute lower limit yet, although usually people go by about a third of a millimeter. But it's definitely, obviously the composition has to be some sort of synthetic polymer-like plastic.
And that's up to 5 millimeters in length. I imagine it could be very, maybe even microscopically small in diameter?
Yeah, 5 millimeters is still something that you would be able to see with the naked eye. Like, there are times when I've looked at the window and I can see these things kind of floating around, because what I found in my study were mostly fibers. And so these things can be airborne. And you can see them. You can certainly see them.
Yeah. And you looked in a lot of places. We'll get into some specifics. A lot of different liquids around the world. And you found these microplastic fibers in a lot of places, right?
Yeah. So the study has three major components. One is looking at 12 brands of beer, as you mentioned, that were all brewed water that was sourced from one of the five Great Lakes. And then the 12 brands of salt that were all purchased here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And those two parts of the study were actually sort of something that my research advisor likes to call Me Too studies. There was a 2014 German study that had looked at 24 brands of German beer, and they found plastic particles there. And then there was a 2015 study that looked at domestically sourced table salt from China. And so we wanted to see if this is just a regional problem or if this is a universal problem, which is why we wanted to, you know, test some things here in the Midwest. And then while we were working on that, an organization called Orb Media was interested in looking at plastic particles in drinking water. And so we partnered with them, and that's what the third component of the study is testing global tap water for plastic particles. And to our knowledge, that has never been done before, not on the scale that we did it.
Yeah, in that global look at tap water, how often did you find these microplastics?
They were quite prevalent. We tested 14 different countries. The average all across the board was about 5.45 particles per liter, and they showed up in very developed countries like the United States and European countries, as well as developing countries like Uganda and Indonesia.
And then how common was it to find the microplastics in the beers you tested?
They were in all of the brands of beer, all 12 brands, varying levels, you know. But what was really curious that we weren't quite expecting is that we thought that there would be a correlation between, because we had the water, where the water was sourced, we had that tested as well, to see if there's a correlation between the number of particles found in that water and then the number of particles found in the beer that was brewed from that water. And we didn't find any correlation between those two. And that, coupled with the fact that the particles that we found were mainly fibers, seems to indicate that there is perhaps something in the processing of the beer where the fibers could be introduced. But that we would need further research for that.
Mary Kosuth is with us with the Dunwoody College of Technology in Minneapolis. She was lead researcher on a study looking for and very often finding these microplastics in drinking water, beer, and elsewhere. Mary, I'm guessing the question on a lot of people's minds now is, okay, this stuff's probably in something I'm drinking. Do we know, is it bad? Is it bad in the amounts we're finding it in to be drinking this stuff?
Right. I guess some of the main concerns currently are the additives that are in the plastics. The plastics themselves can be very stable, which is a good thing, you know, in using it. You know, we don't want our milk jugs to be dissolving, you know, when they're carrying milk. But the problem is that they can remain in that form for a very long time. But they have maybe colorants, UV stabilizers, and then plasticizers like phthalates and bisphenol A that could leach into products or leach into organisms that ingest these microplastics. Another concern is that the plastic particles have been shown to adsorb things like polybrominated flame retardants, PCBs, some heavy metals, some pathogenic bacteria, that these things can attract to the surface of the plastic particle. And by ingesting it, you would be getting a really high dose of that, which you might not otherwise get if they weren't there. But the big kind of area of new research really is looking into nanoplastics, because plastics as we understand them now, they don't biodegrade. Instead, they photodegrade. They just become smaller and smaller and smaller particles. And although we don't really have a huge amount of evidence yet, because the technology just isn't quite there yet to study this and answer all the research questions that we have, but that's kind of the next thing to look at, is are they breaking into nanoparticles? And if that is the case, then there's the potential that those particles could migrate through tissue in ways that microplastics just couldn't because of their size.
And Mary, sometimes with a contaminant in drinking water or food or whatever, one question might be, well, is this from a natural source along the way? One thing, if I understand plastic correctly, one thing we know, it's not coming from a natural source. It's something that humans made, right?
Yes, that's right. It's all derived from natural gas or petroleum, basically. You know, these things can be synthesized, and that's kind of an interesting thing to think about because we go through such lengths to get the stuff out of the ground and transform it into this usable form and transport it and all of that. And then we might use it on an average, like a plastic bag, for like 12 or 15 minutes. And then it's just garbage. It's a single-use item that we just throw away. And we have to really stop and ask ourselves, is this the best way that we can use this resource?
Do we know specifically what the plastic sources are that are putting these microplastic fibers into water, or is there so much plastic out there it's hard to tell?
Sure. Well, I found mainly fibers, again, 98-99%, depending on the product, fibers. And a lot of that comes from textiles. You know, it could be a braiding of carpet fabric. It could be from the fleece that is so popular here in northern in Minnesota and these northern states. But I want to say one thing that the research lab, Sam Mason's research lab, also looked at bottled waters, and they found for the amount, the same size of plastic particles that I found, they found twice as many in the bottled waters, but it was fragments primarily instead of fibers. And so there's all kinds of different sources. They suspect that the fragments could be coming from the material that the caps and closures are made out of, but there are a variety of sources.
As we start to wrap up, Mary, you started to touch on this, but should this be changing, do you think, human behavior as far as the use and disposal of plastic stuff?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think we need to just pause and have a conversation about, as consumers, you know, about, is it really necessary that I have this straw, you know, when I'm at a restaurant? Is it really necessary that I have this plastic bag or this water bottle? There are very popular alternatives now. It's not difficult to find some things out of plastic. But then there are other things that we really need to look to industry to create really biodegradable packaging or to lessen the amount of plastic that they use. And then along with that is, you know, government action on all kinds of levels.
Mary,
I think all of that together is important.
Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for helping us share our findings with the public.
That's Mary Kossuth. She teaches environmental science at Dunwoody College of Technology in Minneapolis. She was with us to talk about her research on microplastics in the Great Lakes, in beer, and in drinking water.
We've been capturing life's moments in photographs for a long time now, but many things have changed. A lot of us have computers with photo folders that are unorganized and cluttered. We take photos on our phones, and we can take as many shots as we want without running out of film.
The family photo album has been a staple in preserving memories for a long time, pulled out maybe during holidays, given as gifts to adult children. What's happening now that our photographs live largely in the digital world? Are we losing something with the fading away way of physical photographs?
Paul Hedges is the digital collections coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So as someone who works as an archivist and in these sort of emerging fields digitally, let's take a step back, though. Were you someone that had these tangible family photo albums?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm old enough to know that lived during a time when analog photos were the only thing we had available to us, and I also am a photographer, so I took a lot of what we call analog photos with negatives, and now I'm all digital, and that has created some interesting challenges as we've moved ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we now no longer, barring maybe some photographers, do maybe their own darkroom stuff anymore. But there used to be, I mean, I also remember going to the one-hour photo, getting my photos developed when I was younger, and the thrill of seeing what was going to come out on, you know, those negatives. Is there something a little bit more to the physical copy of a photo rather than scrolling through your photo library?
Really great question. So the tangible is always something that an analog photo is something that we can share more easily, even with our digital devices. It's much easier for us to take that tangible photo and hold it up for lots of different people to see. But frankly, it's also it's a little bit more stable than our digital. So it's important to think about how to make our photos last longer and printing them out is still kind of the best way to ensure that long term.
Oh, no, all I was going to jump in and say is you're talking about that stability and, you know, having a photo in your hand is different than having a photo maybe in the cloud. Is that what you were getting at a little bit?
You know, I think so. When we take photographs, we want them for ourselves. We want to share them with people. We want to send them around. Certainly digital has helped us provide access to photos that are then immediately available to a wider range of people than a physical print. So that has been a really great benefit of the digital. At the same time, it is it's not always going to necessarily be there. We have to think about where we're putting it and long-term storage. And so there are trade-offs with electronic or digital photographs and trade-offs with print photographs.
What are your thoughts maybe about people being intentional with these photographs? We can take with a smartphone, you know, a million shots to get what we need versus when you had the finite level of film, you know, how has our relationship changed a little bit to that?
Wow. A relationship. As I mentioned, I think as people have moved to a digital photograph, the amount of storage and the amount of photos that we can take allows us to take many, many, many more photographs, which then means it takes more time to select or to weed. Frankly, I think our relationship tends to be we have more than we can deal with on a regular day-to-day basis than when we had a shoebox of print photographs yeah. or 36 negatives from a reel of analog film. So what it kind of means, I guess, to me is that we have more of a challenge of managing those digital photos over time, both in our ability to weed them or to go through them and identify what is special to us. At the same time, they're a little bit out of sight. When you think of putting things on a hard drive, all of a sudden you can put 10,000 photographs on a hard drive and kind of set it aside and not think about it because it doesn't take a lot of space. You print those photos out and all of a sudden 10,000 photographs would take a lot of printed space. So it leads us to kind of maybe hiding away those images and also not necessarily selecting the most valuable images that we want to keep into the future to share with our descendants.
We are talking to Paul Hedges right now. He is the Digital Collections Coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we're talking about the value of preserving memories and photographs, specifically the kind of waning decline of the family photo album. People obviously like having photos. They take a lot of them. Do you think that people are still, that there's still an interest in keeping photo albums around for even, you know, depending on your relationship to, I guess, photography?
I see the ability to create a digital photo album is actually increased quite a bit. It used to be, you know, scrapbooking was super big. My wife was into that. We would take our printed photographs and they'd be put into a scrapbook, etc. Today, you can take all the photos you put into Instagram and you can say, print this out into a photo book, pay $10, $15, and you have all your Instagram photos there in a printed copy that then you can buy 10 of those and then spread them around. Mm-hmm. One of the things we talk about at the Historical Society is this idea basically the family historian kind of taking ownership of possibly twice a year, taking photographs and creating a photo book and then printing 10 or 15 of those photo books and sending them around as Christmas presents. It solves several problems. One is it gets it allows somebody to select the most valuable prints they care about that are in digital. It gets them printed out on stable paper, which can last. And if you do multiple copies, then you spread those photographs around in a stable way that maybe 20, 30, 40 years from now, those photographs will still exist because they're being held by a family member. Today, all of my photos that are in the cloud in Google Drive or Google Photos, I'm not going to ask somebody to go through all of those photos after I'm gone. So purposely creating photo albums is really a valuable way of spreading your photos around, those selected photos, but also preserving them long term.
And what impact do you think that has? I'm going to get a little heady here, on the recipient to have these photos.
Wow. So, you know, I have two sons. There are photos of them. There are photos of us as a family. I think, you know, being able to provide them to them for to hold on to in some tangible way. I mean, if I gave my son a flash drive, he'd put it in a drawer. He'd probably, you know, someday maybe discover it again. Mm. If I print out an 8x12 photo book with not only pictures I've selected, but captions and identifying the people in those pictures, that becomes kind of a long-term record that then he's able to pull out and show, you know, children or, you know, friends later on down the road. So I think it is really super valuable.
And what advice might you have to people who might want to start this process, that might want to create some of these books for their friends or their family?
It's a great question. There are a lot of different ways that this can be done. Flickr, which now has been purchased by a company called SmugMug, those two companies provide easy ways to do photo print books. As I mentioned, you can do that through Instagram, but one of the things I caution people is that Facebook and Instagram, they actually kind of shrink the quality of your photographs, whereas a place like Flickr or SmugMug or pretty much any online photo service that has the ability to send your pictures, your high quality pictures, to a print company. Or you could take your flash drive, select your images, put them on a flash drive, and go to a Walmart or a Walgreens or in-town camera company or some other place that allows for that type of printing. Do it on a kiosk. And again, it's not very expensive to do.
Yeah. We're talking to Paul Hedges. He is the Digital Collections Coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He's with us to talk about photo albums and how to preserve our memories in the digital age.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still keep family photo albums, or have you just started that up? Do you think we're losing something by steering away from having those physical copies of the photos, just having them on our phones and computers? Do you print out digital photos that you've taken? What do you do with them? And do you have questions about how to archive, preserve, cull your collection? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We're talking with Paul Hedges. He's the Digital Collections Coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we're talking about preserving photos in the digital age.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does your family keep a photo album? Do you swap actual physical pictures with friends, with family members? Do you still print off those digital photos ever? Or does your entire collection of photos live in the cloud, online, on your phone, on your computer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we're going to go to one of our callers right now. We have Stacy in Menasha. Hi, Stacy. What do you want to say?
Hi. I have been using Facebook, it's called My Social Book, to put photos together, and I can do it by year, and I can go back to whenever I joined Facebook. But I was wondering, he was just talking about taking your photos to someplace that can capture a higher quality photo. But if I'm taking all my photos on my phone, does that really matter? I mean, they're not really great quality anyway, are they?
So part of that depends on the phone. But one of the things just to consider is that when you upload a photo from your phone to your Facebook app, Facebook will essentially kind of compress that photo down because they want to reduce the amount of storage it takes. And that may have some impact on the print quality. But what I would say is that since you have found a solution that allows you to print the images from photo from Facebook, that and it works for you, then use it. It's really about what kind of meets your needs, and if you're happy with the quality, and you're happy with the way that it works to get you your photo book, then all the better. Just go ahead and keep using it.
And Stacy, thank you so much for that call. And it does bring up kind of what you just mentioned, which was the potential loss of quality and what people should be considering when they are when they're putting together these photo albums. We're going to stick with our calls for right now. We're going to go to Joanne in Ashland. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, how are you?
What did you want to say?
I just think it's a great topic, and I was just excited to hear it on my way home from work. And I just think there's such an importance in photos and printing them, and you know, sitting down with your kids to look at these albums. It's just not the same when you're looking at them on a computer screen. There's just something about an actual scrapbook or photo album that it's just such a value for future generations.
Joanne, thank you so much for that call. And so Joanne is in the camp of having the tangible photos in front of her, being able to share them with her family. You know, that is, I think, a somewhat common opinion. But, you know, how can we make this space for, you know, or the time to be able to share those photos?
It's a great question. You know, I've created photo books for various family trips, for specifically to take old photographs of family members who've passed and to memorialize them. Taken photos of various individuals, etc., and created, in essence, a story. Right, to create a photo book that can inform. And just help document a point in time, which, again, I agree, having something that is tangible that you can share and talk with somebody else is a super valuable experience. We're natural storytellers, all of us, and especially if we have our own personal stories, photo album books allow us to do that. That doesn't mean photo books are the only way to tell stories. Mm-hmm. Some people love to create videos to tell their story and bring photographs into them or create slideshows, and those are as valuable. And those are easier, of course, online to share more broadly, to tell your story to a large group of people. But, you know, when it comes to family memories that you want to have, again, move on through generations, we're still working through how do we make sure that our digital files are actually preserved for long term. And realistically, we have only been dealing with digital files for a short amount of time in humanity, and so we haven't quite figured it out completely yet, and so that's why analog is still so invaluable.
So Joanne, thank you so much for that call, and we are talking to Paul Hedges. He is the digital collections coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we're taking your calls right now about photographs and how we can preserve those memories. And I want to go to Larry in Wazika. Larry, hi, what do you want to say?
Well, I don't know if this is on topic. I just came in from mowing the yard. But I bought a locket at a garage sale at the Mushroom Festival in Muscadet this Saturday. And you open the locket up, It's an inch and a half in diameter, and there are spaces for photographs on both sides of the locket. On one side of the locket, there was a very, very faded paper. The glass was so dirty that you really couldn't make out what was on the paper. But I got the glass out and took the pieces of paper out, and they are two very faded photographs. Underneath those two pieces of paper was a tintype of a black gentleman, very distinguished looking, and his cheeks, I think, are actually colored a rose color. So I'm wondering about the pictures on the faded paper, if they could be digitally enhanced somehow. They're very, very faded, but you can make out a portrait on the smaller piece and barely a portrait on the bigger piece.
So it sounds, and Larry, thank you so much for that call. It kind of sounds like Larry is an amateur historian. He's looking for these photographs and wants to be able to preserve them. What advice do you have for anyone that does want to do something like that?
So certainly something that small can be digitized at a high level to get very close into those images. And there are people who are very good at doing digital enhancement. So certainly it is possible. What I would suggest is to look around in your local area for a camera shop or a place that might do photo scanning, and take it in and have a chat with somebody and see what they can do for you.
Thank you so much for that call, Larry. We're going to go now to Carol in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Carol. What do you want to say?
Hi, Carol. I think your guest, as a Paul, brings up such a good point with, you know, it's not just the individual photos. It's the story that they make together. And I think if you're putting things on Facebook, I don't, but I just did the albums, and then they have really nice photo boxes. And, you know, I had the wonderful experience of showing my grandkids their mom, you know, with their grandmother, five generations, and on my grandma's farm for Easter. And, you know, you're kind of sharing a story that, you know, I wouldn't have those old pictures if I did do the Facebook photo thing up there. And, you know, like they say, pictures are worth a thousand words. And even, you know, making a memory, and it was fun for my daughter too, as well as her kids. So, you know, keep those together. It's not that hard to go to Walgreens or the Flutter. What is the Flutter? Flickr sounds good too, if you have a bunch to do.
And thank you so much for that call, Carol. So Carol is talking about, you know, how we relate and how we, you know, talk about our memories with our family members. We only have a little bit of time left. So what do you think about that?
We, as she mentioned, you know, bringing those photos together into a group and doing a selection is actually something archivists do to bring structure and context around photos, and that's something everybody can do. They have the stories they want to tell, and sounds like she's got it figured out.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us. This is Paul Hedges. He is the digital collections coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he joined us today to talk about the decline of family photo albums in the digital age. You can keep this conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And you can do that, and hopefully, Paul, we can have you back on with us, because this was clearly an important topic, maintaining these photo albums for the past and the future.